Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Writer's Block with Jim Christina, Bobby Bell, and Richard Polinelli, only on LA Talk Radio.
Have you seen the old man in the closed-down market, kicking up the paper with his worn-out shoes? In his eyes you see no pride, and held loosely at his side, yesterday's paper telling yesterday's news. So how can you tell me...
That is Ralph McTell from a 1968 cut called The Streets of London. And he is a British folk singer. And Bobby Jean, you heard that, right? Bobby Jean?
Show you something.
Uh-oh, did we...
We can't have lost her. No, she's here. Bobby, you're here, right? Bobby Jean? Bobby Cha? Bobby Jean?
We have misplaced one-third of our hosting duties here.
Oh, my God. Erin, are you here?
I'm here.
Okay, well, Bobby Jean, she must have hung up.
Uh-oh.
Uh-oh. Well, she'll probably call back.
She is wandering the streets of Albuquerque as we speak.
She's actually wandering the streets of London. So, anyway. All right, well, let's just get this. Okay, let's get this show on the road. You are listening to The Writer's Block. This is LA Talk Radio. My name is Jim Christina. I am your host. I'm in studio tonight with Richard Polinelli, who is our charming and... No, I was going to say lovely.
Yeah, now watch out now. No.
And also handsome and debonair, the co-host in studio. And, of course, my co-host that is out of studio in Albuquerque, she has disappeared. So I don't know where she went, but by golly, we'll see if we can find her.
She went to fill up her coffee cup. She'll be right back.
That would be Bobby Jean Bell, and she's probably putting more Baileys in her cup.
Yeah, we would assume so for
tonight.
Yes.
So this is a Thursday night, of course, and we have a wonderful guest lined up for you this evening. Studio number is 818-602-4929 if you'd like to call in and talk to our guest this evening. And I'm going to let Richard hit it off with his basic shtick at the first part of every show, and we'll go from there. Richard, take it.
All right. If you are a first-time author and you've just typed those glorious words, the end, on your manuscript, you're probably sitting there thinking your work is all done. Now you can just sit back and watch the royalty checks fly on in, right? Wrong. You still need to have that manuscript edited, formatted, and create a book cover for it, and then the hard part really comes in. You have to market it so that readers will know that your book is out there. Now, before you throw your hands up in the air and you throw your manuscript in the trash, take heart as we play a little music. Take heart, because Black Dog Publishing and Tuscany Bee Books are ready to do all of the heavy lifting for you to get your book in front of the readers so you can get paid at a royalty rate that is unmatched in the industry. And more importantly, it'll allow you to get back to doing the important work, writing your next novel. So for more information on the program, you can give Tuscany Bee Books a call at 805-795-3165. You can email them at jchristina@tuscanybaybooks.com, or check out the website at blackdogpublishing.co, and they will get you on your way to publishing success.
There you go. Yay. And guess who showed back up?
Bobby's here.
Bobby, are you here? Really?
What happened to Bobby?
I don't know. She just called in. I just answered it and put her on to join the group. No Bobby. I don't know what
aliens.
She's doing.
It's aliens. She's out in alien country.
It is aliens. I'm telling you. Okay, well, you know what we're going to do? We're going to go right into Out West, which is your online source for top brands that are a reflection of the equestrian and the Western lifestyle. Shop for unique and distinctive apparel, fashion accessories, home decor, and general merchandise. National brands include Rockmount Ranchwear, Scully Leather Company, and American West Handbags, just to name a few. And if you are interested in shopping online, their web address is www.outwestshop.com. outwestshop.com or www.scvoutwest.com. Their toll-free number is, of course, 877-340-9378. And if you enter the code WB100, you'll receive $10 off your first order. So give them a holler. Actually, that's Bobby Jean, who's supposed to be on the other line, and she's nowhere to be found. So I don't know what she did.
Well,
I don't know what I did. I didn't do anything.
I'm going to have to hit their website because in addition to the black hat, I got to get a bolo tie.
Let's see if I can bring her back into our fold here.
Okay.
Bobby Jean, add to group call. Oh, Bobby Jean calling. Here we go. Let's see if we can add her to the group call. Bobby Bell, are you there? Bobby? Bobby Jean? Well, apparently we didn't get her yet. Okay. Since 2009, Target Freight has added full truckload service, TFM truckload, and LTL service. That is the best in the industry. Not only are they exceptionally good at what they do, but they work hard to make your full truckload shipping or LTL experience unparalleled using their customized traffic movement program. So call, there she is. So call TFM truckload or Target Freight Management, LTL, today at 844-653-7789. Ask for Mike Matruski or for truckload or any of the fine account managers at 888-653-1323 for LTL. Tell them you heard it on the Writer's Block, and TFM will have a little something extra for you. Or if you prefer, you can go online at www.targetfmi.com. Bobby, are you here? Bobby?
We'll blame this
okay,
on Heather.
Okay, can you hear me now?
Yes.
There she is.
Okay, we still have Aaron, too, right? Aaron, are you still with us?
Yes.
Oh, all right. I don't know what happened, Bobby. Where'd you go?
I don't know. I could hear you just fine, but you couldn't hear me.
No.
So I must have done something anyway.
You're
happy
back.
To be back and happy to have Aaron on the line.
Oh, yeah. Well, we were talking bad about you. So anyway, Aaron Kriegel, she grew up in the rural Midwest, attended graduate school in the Southwest, and now lives in the Northwest with her partner, Heather, and their son, Henry. Her first book of stories, A Floating Order, was published with Two Ravens Press. Her newest collection, The Whole World at Once, came out in May of 2017 with West Virginia University Press. It was selected for LA's new short fiction series in summer 2017. And would you please welcome to the Writer's Block, of course, Miss Erin Pringle. See? How popular are you, Aaron?
It's standing room only, Aaron.
It is. This studio is absolutely chock full of people you don't ever want to meet.
Yeah. Yeah. And they were about ready to start a Where's Bobby chant, so it's a good thing we got Bobby back on.
We did. So we all read your book. We all came away
with... Wonderful. Thank you.
But you know what our rule at the Writer's Block is? We read the books. Because we cannot have an intelligent conversation about a book unless we do read it. So we do read them.
Oh, I'm so glad because I run a book club, and it's the first book club I've ever been in, and all our members read the books. But I've heard that there are book clubs where people don't really read the book,
right?
But they still get together, and I really don't understand that.
I don't either. I don't know how you can do that.
We call those people winos.
And the refreshments at those club meetings.
Yeah. Yeah. Or they bring their own pitcher of martinis.
There you go.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is what I'm threatening to do next week.
Yeah, but we do, absolutely. We each read cover to cover. And what a collection of stories.
Oh, my goodness.
I can't wait to hear more about tonight with you, Aaron.
My first question is going to come from my gut, because I have to tell you, those stories, they grab you. Where did they come from? Because there are several that are very dark. Indeed, very dark. So at what point in your life did these stories come out?
They're certainly not typically told stories.
No.
Yeah. And so And they are the darker stories that aren't told. And I don't know if stories that are typically not told and stories that are often silenced but happening kind of gain a darkness because of that silencing, or maybe it's the contrast between the silenced stories and the stories that are acceptable to tell that creates that kind of darkness.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly I'm aware of it. I think that the darkness or the silencing, and I think that those are synonymous for me, come from my experiences as a child growing up in a very rural town in the Midwest among cornfields and soybean fields, and it was very isolated. And my parents had me late in life. My mother was 42 and my father was 46. So I was the second round of family. I mean, I was by myself, but like the second round of their lives. I think I was about two when my father was diagnosed with manic depression. And so he became a very isolated person. And in an already very isolated town.
Sure.
And because of the stigma, I mean, there were a number of stigmas or systems kind of at work that functioned to make him disappear within the social system of the town.
Mm-hmm.
There's the systems of that he was born in 1937, and there was definitely a clear path to masculinity that narratives of mental illness contradict.
Mm-hmm.
And then the small town kind of like illusion of Americana and nostalgic values and Christian enlightenment, you know, those are also in contradiction to mental illness or conceptions of family that don't fit certain images of what a family's supposed to look like.
Mm-hmm.
Or a successful family supposed to look
sure.
like. I don't know. So and my mom grew up in the same time period, and so her way of dealing with things that don't fit society is to go silent about them. Mm-hmm. And I don't think not in a purposely cruel way or in a way to purposely shame anyone. I think it's a kind of like a nurturing, protective way of how she's been taught to pass or mm-hmm. how she's been, you know, like blend.
Mm-hmm.
It's a safety mechanism for her. And mm-hmm. so we didn't, I mean, I knew Dad was depressed, but he didn't have a job, but he was pretty much kept in the house. I mean, I was aware of that, you know, that he was heavily medicated. And later in life, I think I was in my 20s when a psychiatrist told me that, and my father was dead by this point, not of mental illness, of cancer, but that my father had been basically an experiment, you know, because nobody, I mean, even though it had been 20 years before in the 80s, at the time that I was talking to this person, she was saying, well, you know, the doctors would have been kind of experimenting on the different kinds of medications that would help him. So he was sleeping a lot during my life. But, I mean, so there were these contrasts. I think this is where the darkness comes from,
mm-hmm.
is that he'd grown up in this very small village of 700 people, and not where I grew up, but close to there. And he was a very artistic man. So there, before the depression became too much for him to kind of blend within the systems of society and jobs and things like that, he did a lot of painting. He looked at a lot of art. There were these kind of modernist sculptures in my backyard and front yard, which is not typical at all. Like, that does not happen in a small town, right? So he was already he'd already kind of lived this oddness defined by the contrast of the people who raised him and the Midwest, right? And so I mean, I had these memories of he would take me to the library when I was, you know, 4, 5, 6, and we would go to the art section, and we would sit on the floor, and we would look through the, you know, those huge, not huge, well, to me, as a kid, mm-hmm. little, these huge art books of Renaissance art and Vermeer and Renoir and the Impressionists, and he really liked Van Gogh, and he had some prints in his room of the of Gauguin and Matisse, you know, like all of these words I learned from him. So at the same time that he didn't fit within this place, he was trying to access with me these other ways of seeing the world. Mm-hmm. So there was such beauty that was also coming in at the same time. And I think that's where, and I think that that's always how I've kind of seen reality, or been, or where reality makes most sense, is when there's this kind of strange silencing going on, but at the same time, people are trying to see beauty and mm-hmm. trying to make it through the silencing. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a lot where the darkness comes from. Because I saw other children my age, you know, they were being silenced too with abuse and things like that. But in school, we were supposed to not talk about that or even acknowledge that was happening, you know. So, yeah.
Wow.
Does that answer?
Yeah. more. Okay. Actually, yeah. Actually, there's three letters for that. It's TMI. No. No, but as far as manic depression goes, in the early part of the 60s and early 70s, they really didn't know what that was. And a lot of people were just shut away in rooms and medicated and kept quiet and sleeping, and, you know, because they didn't know how else to handle it. So I can sure see where that could really screw a family up.
May I?
Within like the isolated rural, you know, like it wasn't
right.
In New
and
York
then
City
being
where there might
being
have been.
In an isolated spot in an isolated town in rural Iowa or wherever you were, dragging around a red wagon that said Helen on it.
Yeah,
you know.
So I just want to jump in for a second if I can. It's so hard to be at a distance. So we're talking about your book because I'm not sure we even gave the title. We're so excited to chat with you. So. We're talking about a wonderful collection of short stories, and the book is titled The Whole World at Once.
Yes.
And each story, we're talking about it being dark, but at the same time, the language that you write with, it's to me, it was like looking at a much textured painting, that the language is more compelling than, say, an action-driven story. There certainly are actions that happen, but these are stories really about a grief and love and how you show us the characters in the stories are grappling with these kinds of issues. And often it's kids that what I saw over and over again is we've got young people in the stories. We've got adults as well. But we're seeing a lot of the stories through the eyes of young folks. And they're often without names.
Yes.
So can you tell us a little bit about, and you touched on it, I think, in the what you just shared, but a little bit about writing through the eyes of youth and perhaps why you've chosen to really limit the use of names.
Sure, yeah. Yeah. Thank you for that summary of the stories. I should have written that down so I can repeat it.
You can play this podcast back.
The book's about.
Yeah, we're on demand. You can go back and steal anything you want later. You're good.
Oh, good.
Absolutely.
I think there's multiple reasons in the moment of writing and in reflection on why I might be doing this, of why I think I'm doing this. Where should I start? I started watching about the same time that I was writing my first book. I was taking a lot of children's literature courses in grad school, and I had taken those in undergrad, and my mother had been a third grade teacher, so I read a lot of children's lit and folk tales and fairy tales of the folk tale-ish nature. And one thing that I noticed is that I always felt I inhabited the story more as a reader when I didn't have a name. Mm-hmm. And when the character didn't have a name, that the name kind of functioned to distance me from the character, like a barrier or mm-hmm. a creation, maybe even like a barrier of the body or a barrier of skin does, you know, when we talk to each other. And in a small town, names are absolutely how people oppress each other. It's how they love each other and know each other, but it's also histories of why someone is the way they are. So my mother and my mother is huge into names and who is related to who and whose maiden name, you know, who used to be so-and-so and this person's parents and the time then in the time when, and I don't know if it's just a rural thing because she and my grandmother would talk about this too when we would visit her in Evansville, Indiana, and names were very important. It was, and so I kind of watched growing up how teachers responded to children based not on who the child was sitting before them, but on that name belongs to the people who have been living in, you know, the same falling apart house for 50 years. So this child doesn't have a future, so there's no point wasting time here. You know, like they were, and there was so much interaction with teachers and the histories of children rather than teachers and the children who were before them. So it's, and at the same time that I don't think that we realize that was part of the dialogue of our educations. But mom was a teacher or had been, so I knew that these discussions happened, you know. And so one way to free somebody is to take the name, to let them not have to have a name that's not attached to anything, and to sort of see how experiences affect a person regardless of what their name is, and the way that people's past and current actions kind of create these strange actions and reactions that as a human being still have to be dealt with, regardless of what someone else is interpreting, how they would be interacting, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. So if, like in Spawn My Heart, where the girl is dealing with deceased parent grief, just so much grief, mm-hmm. and her brother who's come back from war, who's dealing with his own grief, if I were to call them the Hendersons, right, then any reader, at least in my imagination, any reader who knows the Hendersons feels like they are not the Hendersons. Like, we're just going to observe the Hendersons, and the Hendersons' lives are unique to the Hendersons. Mm-hmm. We could not become the Hendersons, but I don't think that's true.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I could see myself, well, you know, you have this wonderful gift to take us back to our childhood, too. I marvel at that when authors can take us, transport us back to a time and it becomes so authentic. I have such little memory, truly, of, you know, being 7 or 8 or 9 or 10. I don't much remember anything till college, I think. But you take us back, and I lived in a rural part of Connecticut in my early years, and I can remember wandering through the woods and different things. And these kids are very perceptive how they look at something, a locust, you know, how they look at something, and you share how really observant they are and how they're putting the world together. And I don't remember doing that as a kid, but then as I read these characters, I go, you know, I remember thinking about things like that, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, so I think you're right. Not naming, you know, I could relate to the little boy that goes out in the woods on the snow, and you talk about how it crunches under feet, and, you know, he snuck out of the house, and, you know, we've all done that or something like that, right, Jim and Richard?
I don't know. We're out for coffee.
We just checked out for a while.
You know, and then suddenly he's in a life and death situation. And gosh, I was right with him. I could feel it. I could sense it. I felt like she's put me right here with him.
Well, you know, a lot of your stories are, they are accurate as per people. They truly are, and as you're reading, especially in The Lightning Tree, for some reason that story really got to me, and I'm not sure why, other than the fact that at the very end of that story, he was carrying his wife up to the tree, and I knew why, because of his belief. I don't want to give the story away because it's such a wonderful story.
Right.
But there were several pieces like that throughout your book that were so poignant, and that, and I had to stop and reread them several times because they just were so good. It was all really good, but there were just several pieces in there that just grab you. I mean, right, they tug at your heart.
Well, you have to read it again because you also love to leave things unresolved, or, you know, I'd have to go back and read again, like, wait a minute, you know, I gotta go back and wait a minute, I gotta read this one again.
I just want to know, Aaron, did it work on the Lightning Tree? Did it work?
Well, I think that the wish for wishing is a important one, you know, the wish.
Yeah.
The wish, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I just remember really wishing for the ability to wish, you know, and that it was often talked about, like, here are magicians and they can get away with this stuff, you know, or God, they can get away with this stuff. But there's something very human keeping you from these abilities.
Right, right.
That would, you know, and that kind of longing for that ability to shift reality at particular instances, not to really fix anything, but just to understand the moment, maybe, you know, using, yeah.
Well, so, I mean, you know, it's nice to be able, I always thought that if I had three wishes, I would wish for long life, good health, and three more wishes.
Yes, always. Why don't they wish for more wishes?
Right. Yeah.
No, it's in the small print. You can't do that.
Yeah, I know. Well,
I think we've all gone through it, right?
There are no benevolent genies.
If we can control this. Yeah.
Hey, we're going to stick you on pause here for just a moment while we do one more commercial, okay. And then we'll be back to you in a couple seconds. So hang tough. Don't go away.
All right. Awesome.
Okay. All righty. You're on.
You're leaving on vacation. Tickets have been purchased. Hotel reservations are confirmed. Mail delivery has been suspended. Uh-oh. What about the dog? All Dogs Rule Day Camp and Sleepovers. It's the place your dog wants to be when they can't be with you. All Dogs Rule provides your best four-legged friend a place to run and play outside among orange trees and grass in a country setting. Your dog gets to be, well, a dog. All Dogs Rule offers additional services including individualized playtime, personal walks, swimming sessions in the creek, and training. With my dog keeps swimming. They couldn't get him back out.
Yeah, he couldn't get mine in the water.
Visit All Dogs Rule on the web at alldogsrule.com or give them a call at 805-524-1100. And when your pup returns home, that smile on his face will leave you wondering, whose vacation was better? The dogs.
The dog. Okay, this is LA Talk Radio. This is the Writer's Block. It is now 7:28, and we have, as a guest tonight, Aaron Pringle, who has written just a phenomenal a book of short stories, and we're discussing about the humanity in the stories and some of the darkness and the fact that she does not use names. And Bobby Jean has been pretty much leading the conversation. So welcome back to the show, Aaron. And Bobby Jean, before we go anywhere, BJ, we have to ask her the question, and she knows it's coming.
Go ahead and ask.
No,
it's all you.
Do you want me to ask myself the question?
No.
Yeah, go ahead, Aaron. You know what it is.
No, go
Richard, take that question.
I did that last week. It's your turn.
All right, I'll ask. All right. I just told everybody in the world that the name of this program is The Writer's Block. Well, The Writer's Block is something that most writers eventually get. Some never do. Aaron, have you ever had writer's block? And if you have, how did you get through it?
So we did talk about that you were going to ask me this question.
Yes, I
did.
So
I've been thinking
did.
About it. Because when people have asked me in the past, I feel like I give the wrong answer. So I think that writer's block I haven't really had. If we're talking about like my ability to create words on the page and not sit in front of a blank page. But I think that's because I've had people block though, where, and I think it might be the same phenomenon. So as a kid, I read quite a lot all the time. And that's where I always felt most real and most authentic and most engaged with the world and safest with reading. Mm-hmm. And because my dad painted and did sculpture and we looked at paintings and I painted and did drawings, like expression was always the safe thing that one could do. Mm-hmm. Like no one can get, and you know, as far as I knew, and I think I still carry this myth in a very productive way, that people can't get in the way of your imagination and your ideas. I mean, they can, but I had this myth that they couldn't, because that's where I kind of protected. So my outward personality is pretty socially engaging, and I learned from my dad how to tell jokes, but mainly so people would leave me alone because they scare me. So I think I have people's block, you know, where if an event's going to come up and I know that I'm going to have to go talk to people, I get really, really anxious and I don't want to do it.
Gotcha.
And I imagine all the ways that they're going to criticize me if I say the wrong thing. My therapist calls it social anxiety, but ways of coping. And I think that's probably, the more I think about it, what writer's block must be like for people who write. Mm-hmm. I mean, for people who experience it, right? Mm-hmm. I don't imagine an audience of people when I'm writing, and so they're not criticizing me. I'm just imagining what's happening within the mind of the character or the story, or I'm paying attention to the language. I'm not open to that kind of old-fashioned party line of voices ready to tell me everything that's wrong with me. Mm-hmm. And why I shouldn't be writing this, or why I'm breaking the mold or anything like that, even though I'm doing all of those things. But within my social life in the rural town, that was constant and consistent of, I can give numerous examples, you know, of like in fifth grade, Mrs. Driga did not want me to sing If I Were a Rich Man from Fiddler on the Roof because I was not a man. Even though it's the funniest song, and I love it, and I love him as a character, and what a dark but beautiful song that is, right? Like the restraints on him as a low-income man within this village and religion and the larger political system. And I really wanted to sing that song. Also, he had a great beard, like my dad did. So Mrs. Driga, you know, like Mrs. Driga said, no, you can't sing it, not because I wasn't able to sing the notes, but because I was a girl, you know, and that's when the system comes out and talks, but usually it doesn't. It just silences in other ways, you know, like what's acceptable for playing as a girl on the playground in rural Casey, Illinois. Well, I'm not supposed to be playing with the boys, even though I am, but I know I'm not, you know, like that constant awareness of not right. And other kids were happy to join that, you know, and so I was the weird kid and the creative kid, and evidently I was the gay kid, but I didn't know that for 30 years, because I had so ingrained, you know, what it was to be within society, and it was not a pleasant place. So I think my writer's block has been a people's block.
Oh.
Are you still there?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Fascinating. I'm sitting fascinated.
And it's about, yeah.
Much
that's
like
why
your
we
writing.
Love this show, and we love to ask that question. That's why, because we're always the guest always shares something that's so authentic and kind of mind opening. You know that everyone has such an interesting take on that.
Well, I think it's a bare naked question, and I think it catches some people off guard.
It did me the first time you sprung it on me.
There you go.
Yeah.
But we spring it on everybody.
If I had spring another question on me.
There you go.
Aaron, whatever you'd like to do.
Aaron, I got a question for you, because I, as a writer and doing the self-publishing that I do, I'm always looking for different new ways people are putting their books together, not so much the story, but in other ways. And I've noticed the book we had last week and then your book this week are fiction novels, but they have discussion questions at the end. And I was wondering, that's something you don't see in fiction a lot. Is it because these are books that you're aiming toward book clubs, or is there another purpose to putting these questions out? Are you trying to focus the reader's attention on a specific point by doing that?
Well, I think it's part of the sort of house style that my publisher uses. So my editor is the one who said, we need discussion book. You know, I would like to put discussion questions at the back of your book, and it is for book clubs, and readers seem to respond to this as part of the format of the books we publish or books that are published. So, so I wouldn't have even thought to do it on my own.
Mm-hmm.
And even if I thought of it, I probably wouldn't have done it.
Yeah. Did you write your questions yourself, or did they suggest questions?
I did.
Okay.
No, she said, yeah. So I wrote them thinking of, I taught college writing for 13 years. So I thought of, I just imagined myself was in the classroom, and if we were talking about these stories, and I wanted, you know, what, like to really get into a discussion about the stories and not to, like, did you understand this or that? Like, you know, what questions would I ask?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, so I wrote most of the questions, and then I had the woman who, Rachel King, who edited the manuscript or suggested, you know, like typos or, you know, what about this? I said, why not, could you tell me a couple questions that you yourself would want to know answers to? Because I was having a hard time fully imagining the audience I'm writing to, right? Hence, no writer's block. Like, there's no audience. No one's going to read my book. so why would I ask them questions?
Well, it's a good thing you're not a member of a speaker's bureau.
Yeah, it is. So she suggested, I think, the very last question about the rural America and the isolation. And I think she asked the last two or three questions, and those they seemed really well, like on point, and right. I wouldn't have thought to ask those. Yeah. So they're mostly me, but some of Rachel King.
Do you see that as a trend that's going to happen with all fiction, or is it just specific fiction books in certain areas that you see we're going to have the discussion questions? But some books, like, you know, I write sci-fi, so I cannot for the life of me imagine what kind of a discussion question I would write at the end of one of mine. But is that something you see is going to branch out?
Oh, I have noticed now that I do this book club, because I'll write my own questions for a book club to think about, but I will go online to see if they're not in the book, if there are any discussion questions. So we just read Claudia Rankine's poetry book, Citizen, which is fantastic. And I don't think there weren't questions at the back of her book, but on Grey Wolf Press's website, there were discussion questions. And so it looks like there must be some awareness in readers to go look at a press website to look for discussion questions.
Gotcha.
And on a couple other books, one fiction of short stories, I forget the publisher, but they had discussion questions in the back. And I noticed in the, I'm a reader within another book club, and we've been reading YA, and both books had question and answers at the end of the book.
Mm-hmm.
So it must be just an on the rise trend.
Gotcha. I'm gonna,
maybe to cope with internet. I don't know.
Yeah, it could very well
or to
be.
Encourage community, or like this is how you deal with each other when you are together because you're usually on the internet. I don't know.
Oh, well, it's yeah. Either way. We're going to have our roving reporter call in here in just a minute. You're more than welcome, and in fact, I hope you do stick around with us. But if right now, if you would give our audience your email address and your website and all your information where they can contact you.
Yes. My website is erinpringle.com. Erin, E-R-I-N, Pringle like the potato chip, .com. And you can contact me through there and stay in the loop of what I'm doing. And sometimes I've been interviewing writers more lately, mm-hmm. And I've been reading a lot more than I ever have in a long time.
Oh, so
I started writing quick write-ups of what I'm reading. So you can follow along that way. And I'm on Facebook. And it's Erin. You can just search the Erin T. Pringle or Erin Pringle, and you'll find me. And then on Twitter, it's based on my website name, which was What She Might Think.
Right.
Because of the social anxiety, right? I'm not going to say that I do think this. I might think this. So Twitter is @ what she might. So that's how you can follow on
okay,
Twitter.
Great.
Does
great.
That answer? Yeah.
Now, don't go away. I think we have Henry on the line with us right now. Henry, you there?
I'm here.
Oh, right. Henry,
I'm not like
meet...
Bobby Jean. I'm not hiding.
Okay. Meet
I'm
Henry.
Sorry, Bobby.
Henry, meet Erin Pringle.
Hey.
I'm here. Hi,
well, hey.
Henry.
Hi,
this is,
how's
this
going,
is Henry
Aaron?
Park.
Enjoying,
he's our roving Western reporter.
Very much.
Oh, thanks.
Well,
it's been going well. Go for it.
So, yep. What do you got going, Henry?
Okay. Well, now the big news is that we have finally a premiere date for Yellowstone, the new Western series starring Kevin Costner, created by Taylor Sheridan, the Sons of Anarchy actor turned writer director. It's going to start playing on the new Paramount Network on June 20th.
Excellent.
Yeah. If you, I'll make sure I put up a link to the new trailer on the new Roundup, and it's you see it, and you will want to see the show, no question.
Oh, I saw that. I saw a brief trailer for it the other day. It was wonderful,
isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, now the new Roundup will also feature part one of my interview with Kent McCrae, who produced and was production manager on Bonanza, High Chaparral, and Little House on the Prairie. This first part is about his early years in live TV, working with Groucho Marx on You Bet Your Life, and with Bob Hope on the Christmas specials he did at the military bases around the globe.
Mm-hmm.
This is something McCrae did all the coordinating on, which is, as you know, a hell of a job.
Yeah.
I've got a couple of book reviews. I know you folks... No Western novelist D.B. Jackson, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, his soon-to-be-published novel, Small Moving Parts, set in Texas in 1958, is a terrific tale and terrific read. Now, back about 8 years ago when I first started writing Henry's Western Roundup, a woman took issue with a positive review I gave a movie, and she commented, "I don't consider a movie a Western if there isn't even one saloon fight." Well, and I never thought of it that way, but I mean, people do have these rules.
Well,
and if you
yes,
like on-screen now, fighting, you're going to love Gene Freeze's new book, Classic Movie Fights: 75 Years of Bare Knuckle Brawls, 1914 to 1989.
God, they'll write about anything, don't they?
Yeah.
Well, Henry, I have to tell you that Aaron lives in Spokane, where they still do have saloon brawls.
Oh yeah, I'm recovering from one.
Oh dear. Can I get you some ice?
No, I'm gonna experience it in the full pain of it.
There you go.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's sort of interesting with the book. The reason he chose to start it in 1914 was that year's film, The Spoilers, had the first great movie fight, and there was no such thing as stunt fighting, so the stars, William Farnham and Tom Sanchi, just beat the living hell out of each other on camera.
Oh,
wow.
Oh.
It was tough to be an actor in 1914, huh?
He stops looking at movies after 1989, and I thought that was arbitrary, but his point is, in 1990, CGI started taking over.
Mm-hmm.
And with flashy cutting, shaky cameras, I find it even hard to watch a fight because, you know, everything gets so smeary and blurry now.
Yeah, yeah.
Looking at a terrific DVD collection from Mill Creek Entertainment. It's simply called 20 Movie Western Collection. It's only about $25. And, you know, for that kind of price, you expect a bunch of public domain, hard to watch.
Did we lose you?
Uh-oh.
All Columbia Pictures Westerns, beautiful prints, lots of Randolph Scott, including almost all of the Bud Dedeker films, plus several with Glenn Ford, William Holden, including Arizona, the movie they built old Tucson Studios for.
Right.
Even two Tim McCoys and a Buck Jones that all feature John Wayne at like 20 years old.
Wow.
Those were horrible movies.
Which
Party
one?
History.
John Wayne's early Three Musketeers and his really early films. They were terrible.
Yeah, but they got a place in history, right, Henry?
That's true. I really like the Mesquite. I never could figure. Is it Mesquiteers, Mesquiteers?
Mesquiteers.
Mesquiteers.
Filmed in Corriganville. Yeah, they were fun.
Oh, also, this year is the 25th anniversary of the film Tombstone, and I'll have details about a planned cast reunion celebration right in the actual town of Tombstone, not in Old Tucson.
Wow.
Well, that ought to be interesting.
And you can learn all about this and more at www.henryswesternroundup.blogspot.com.
Henry, you are the man, and we're going to be seeing you next month, yeah?
Absolutely.
And along with D.B. Jackson,
would not miss the Santa Clarita Cowboy Festival for anything.
There you go. There you go. Thanks,
Me
Henry.
Me neither.
All right.
Talk to you in a couple weeks.
Great, Bobby. You coming back for it?
Yes, I'll be there on Saturday.
Outstanding.
And I'll be in the studio of the Writer's Block that Thursday night of that week, and then I'll be at the festival on Saturday. Looking forward to it. Yeah.
Wonderful.
And would you like to say who's going to be on the air with us that night while you're in with the studio with us?
No, you say that.
John Sanford is with us that night.
Say it again, I laugh.
John Sanford. Come on, Aaron, you know who John Sanford is, don't you?
No.
Really? Do you ever go to an airport and go to a bookstore?
Oh, gosh.
No, I don't.
Uh-oh. Oh, that would explain why.
What program is this?
We may have to send you a John Sanford book along with your coffee mug so you can be familiar.
Okay.
We must baptize you in the cult of John Sanford.
Yes.
Is what we need to do.
Apparently.
Yes.
Apparently.
Please do.
You need to come out of Iowa, girl.
It'll help you avoid those bar fights in Spokane.
You didn't tell me yesterday that you were going to ask a question about John Sanford.
Oh, no, it's not a question.
It's okay, Aaron. I actually wasn't familiar with him either, but I am learning now.
Well, you have one of his books, BJ. So anyway. Okay, well, thanks, Henry. Are you still there, Henry?
Oh, I'm still here.
Thanks, man.
I'm glad that no one asked me who John Sanford is.
Well, Google him.
Hey, Henry, did you get your interview with Wes Studi in yet?
No, but I...
Oh, come on. You're killing me here.
Well, he was at the Oscars. You know, he's had a busy calendar, I'm sure.
Well, look him up, Bobby.
Oh,
he lives in New Mexico.
He was terrific at the Oscars.
He's just down the road from Bobby Jean. She can get you hooked up.
Yeah, go find him.
And no problem.
Okay.
Outstanding.
Thanks, Henry.
Okay. Thank you.
Talk to you in a couple weeks. Bye-bye. Well, Aaron, you got to be in on Henry Parks' bit. Aren't you impressed?
That was great.
We occasionally throw a pop quiz at people just to see what happens. Hey, you know, it's what we do.
This is what we do here at the Writer's Block. And so
we have fun.
We do. And let me tell you, next week we have Peggy Chambers with us, who's her first book, Secrets of Sand Hill Island, was a smash. And she's written another one, Different People, Same Island. The 22nd, we have Kelly Sharon. And 29th, we have Peggy Wheeler, who is the Raven's Daughter author. April is going to be a busy month for us. On the 5th, we have John Leonard Pilmier. The 12th, we have Karen Lee. The 19th, John Sanford. The 26th is Bruce Solheim, who we are working on a book for right now. And then, of course, the 20th. And the 21st, 22nd is the Santa Clarita Cowboy Festival, in which Bobby Jean will be there for Saturday only. You and Dale Jackson.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's partly why we're going Saturday. We don't want to miss a few moments with Dale.
Oh, I know. Me either. I get to spend all day with him, so.
You'll get all day with him.
I know. Yeah. Well, Aaron, thank you so much for joining us. It was a treat having you, and you've been just a terrific to lay down and just let us tromp on you, which was what we like to do.
Well, excellent. I'm glad that you enjoyed that.
Oh, we did. We did. You know, good sports are good sports, no matter where they live. I told you my son was a guest for the state up in Airway, so.
You did. And my son's named Henry. So it was really nice to listen to another Henry speak.
Well, there you go. So, wow.
Yeah.
We just all kinds of stuff.
I know, coincidences. It's such a small town. Really.
I know. What are you going to do?
This world.
So anyway, I'm going to send you a coffee mug. I'm going to send you a John Sanford book. I won't sign it because I'm not John Sanford.
I'll be a guest interviewer when he comes.
No.
I don't know. She can call in.
You can. You're more than welcome to call in. All right, we're going to have to get out of here. Thanks again for joining us, Aaron. It's just been a hoot. And look for your stuff on probably Tuesday. Keep writing. You write great stuff.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, you're just so welcome. And for, for Bobby Jean and myself and Aaron, who's maybe still around, just for the writer's block in general. This is another Thursday. We pretty much shot right in the butt.
Yep.
So with that being said, Bobby Jean, good night. Richard, good night.
Good night.
And we are out of here.